3, Practicing Team Medicine, from Leonard Berry and Kent Seltman, Management Lessons from Mayo Clinic. 100 times better if you are an unyielding literalist, doubtless exaggerated, but in any case, one damn big deal and one damn big endorsement for Dr. Mayo's collaborative medicine. Alas, AWOL in most hospitals in 2018. 1.5. Words from the Master. Peter Drucker on True Top Management. The head of one of the large management consulting firms asks, "And what do you do that justifies your being on the payroll?" The great majority answer, "I run the accounting department," or "I'm in charge of the sales force." Only a few say, "It's my job to give our managers the information they need to make the right decisions," or "I am responsible for finding out what products the customer will want tomorrow." The man who stresses his downward authority is a subordinate, no matter how exalted his rank or title. But the man who focuses on contributions and who takes responsibility for results, no matter how junior, is in the most literal sense of the phrase, top management. He holds himself responsible for the performance of the whole. Peter Drucker. Attitude and sense of responsibility matters way more than rank. It's a profoundly important comment. In fact, it's my favorite Druckerism, and that's saying something since I'm a pretty good student of Drucker. I'm particularly keen on the notion that focusing on contributions and results vaults even the lowest level manager into top management in Mr. Drucker's assessment. 1.6. Fixing execution roadblock number 1. 1.6.1. Cross-functional excellence, XFX. Poor cross-functional coordination and communication is the principal element in the delay of everything. A dogmatic statement to be sure, but after 50 years of practice and observation said with certainty. Hence, it is axiomatic that the pursuit of XFX, cross-functional excellence, is of surpassing importance. I fervently believe that in most any organization of, say, more than a dozen people, the number one issue that causes delays, implementation failures in general, employee angst and customer ire is failures of cross-functional communication and integration. Important addenda number 1. New style organization forms, regardless of their fancy monikers and supporting software architecture, have not and will not come within a mile of eliminating functional units like finance or engineering. Believe it. In fact, the new software can make things worse. Attendant depersonalization, let the software do it, is the kiss of death when it comes to truly value-adding cross-functional coordination. Important addenda number 2. The commonplace argument in 2018 is that fluid, project team-driven enterprises of tomorrow will eliminate the need for departments. While I dislike the term department and prefer internal professional service firm, or PSF, see section 12.2.9, I believe that the opposite is true. Enterprises today are appropriately in relentless pursuit of increasing intellectual property. To a significant extent, that is dependent upon collections of specialized talent, another term for department, or PSF. It is, alas, fair to say that our internal barriers, not our competitors' cleverness, are the principal impediments to effective execution and, hence, competitiveness. I suspect you'd mostly agree with that in a theoretical way. But do you see that a daily obsession with achieving cross-functional excellence, or XFX, is what I call, with no hyperbole, SO1, strategic opportunity number 1? I'd add that achieving XFX is not so much about dealing with negatives, fixing coordination problems, as it is about creating a basis for sustainable competitive advantage, the ultimate positive. To perhaps unnecessarily repeat, XFX is not primarily about, let's stop this damn feuding between purchasing and finance. The goal is to be able to say, purchasing and finance teams supporting one another are improving operational performance and profitability alike through innovation and spirited, coordinated execution. 1.6.2. And if XFX is such a peerless opportunity, where do you start? Simple. Never waste a lunch. Lunch equals cross-functional friction reduction agent number one. Lunch, strategic importance, yes. Implication and task. Initiate a formal strategic LDP, lunch diversification program. Action item, percentage of XF lunches. Measure your number of cross-functional lunches, lunches with people outside your unit, monthly. Make that measurement part of everyone's formal evaluations. Exceptions notwithstanding, see the commentary above, superior system software can abet cross-functional coordination. But XFX, cross-functional excellence, is primarily a people relationship thing. Lunch is a big part of a set of what I call cross-functional social accelerators. That is, winning the game is a lot more about soft, social, cultural factors than it is about upping software investment by, say, $5 million. 1.6.3. XFX equals personal. Personal relationships are the fertile soil from which all advancement, all success, all achievement in real life grow. Ben Stein, investment and economics guru. True in 1718, 1818, 1918, 2018, and so often treated as a catch-as-catch-can rather than the byproduct of care and sustained and yes, even calculated effort. XFX equals personal relationships. 1.6.4. XFX is social. The social accelerators underpinning XFX. Lunch, personal relationships. XFX is, was, and will be a social affair. And in that spirit, I offer here a list of what I call social accelerators, a set of so-called soft ideas that taken together would go a long, long way down the path to achieving long-lasting cross-functional excellence. To wit, 1. Everyone's job 1. Make friends in other functions. 2. Do lunch with people in other functions frequently. 3. Religiously invite counterparts in other functions to your team meetings and actively include them in your discussions. Ask them to present cool stuff from their world to your group. Useful and a mark of respect. 4. Proactively seek examples of tiny acts of XFX to acknowledge privately and publicly. 5. Present counterparts in other functions awards for service to your group. Tiny awards at least weekly and an annual all-star supporters banquet. 6. When someone in another function asks for assistance, respond with more alacrity than you would if it were the person in the cubicle next to yours or even more than you would for an external customer. 7. Do not badmouth the damned accountants, the bloody HR guy. Ever. 8. Establish adhocracy as SOP. Small cross-functional teams should be formed on the spot to deal with an urgent issue. 9. Within days of coming aboard, the newbie should be running some bit of a bit of a bit of a project, working with people from other functions. Hence, working together becomes as natural as breathing. 10. Try your darndest to arrange a temporary assignment for each of your people somewhere in the finance department. Get to know the numbers people, perhaps career advice tip number 1. 11. Get them out with the customer. Give everyone more or less regular physical customer-facing experiences. Such experiences are peerless motivators. One gets to literally see the impact of one's work. 12. Everyone, starting with the receptionist, should have an XF rating component in their evaluation. XFX performance should be among the top 3 items in all managerial evaluations. 13. Every unit should be formally evaluated by other functions concerning its usefulness and effectiveness and value added to the enterprise as a whole. 14. Demand sustained XF experience for especially senior jobs. For example, the U.S. military requires all would-be generals and admirals to have served a full tour of duty in a job whose only goals were cross-functional achievements. 15. Excellence. There is a sublime state of XF excellence. Talk it up constantly, pursue it, aspire to nothing less. 1.6.5 XFX, suggested addition to statement of core values. If the importance of XFX is as great as I suggest, then XFX is a candidate for membership in the stratosphere, part of no less than the set of enterprise core values. Consider. We will not rest until seamless cross-functional integration and communication has become a primary source of value added. Excellence in cross-functional integration shall become a daily operational passion for 100% of us. Repeat. The whole point here is that XFX is almost surely the number one opportunity for strategic differentiation. While many might agree with that statement, in our moment-to-moment affairs, XFX is not so often visibly and perpetually at the top of every agenda. I argue here for no less than visible, constant, measurable obsession. 1.7.1 Execution. Parting Thoughts 1. Measurable Time Spent on How-To's. Execution is a systematic process of rigorously discussing hows and whats, questioning, tenaciously following through, and ensuring accountability. Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan, Execution. One implication. Will, for example, the next presentation you give allot more time to implementing than to the analysis of the problem? Measure this. 1.7.2 Execution, Parting Thoughts 2, Revel in the Politics. Implementation of anything is all about politics. If you don't like politics, forget about leading anything of any size at any time. Politics is not a dirty word about a dirty topic. Politics, in the words of Otto von Bismarck, quote, is the art of the possible, the attainable, unquote. The day I put this section together, I happened to chat with a friend who runs an exceptionally successful tech-based company in L.A. Customers include the hyper-hard-nosed Walt Disney Company. He's not a kid by a long shot, and I asked him why he kept going. He makes 2 cross-country round trips from the East Coast each month. He said he loved the challenge, driven by the changing tech scene, of staying ahead of the game. Then he surprised me by adding, "You know, Tom, the fact is that I really enjoy the back and forth with our clients, and I like putting things together and figuring out how to wiggle my way through their internal politics." In other words, he gets off on the politics of getting his thing done. Sound absurd? Not at all to me. Many of the most successful folks I know get a buzz from the phrase, "Putting the human political puzzle together is their true talent." Consider this long and hard in your promotion decisions in particular. Does she or he enjoy the great game of getting things done in messy political environments? Or does she or he bitch and moan that, quote, every damn thing is political around here? Corollary. In the real world of execution, EQ beats IQ. That is, the EQ, emotional intelligence quotient, is more important to mastering the execution process than the standard IQ, intelligence quotient. This is obviously not to dismiss the book learning flavor of intelligence, but is to say that all effective leadership is primarily about feeling your way through the people and politics puzzle. 1.7.3 Execution. Parting Thoughts 3. Talk the talk. The iron law of execution. When you talk all the time about execution, it's likely to happen. When you don't, it doesn't. Question. Could it be this simple? Answer. To a significant degree, yes. FYI, this in fact translates into a practical action item and starts today. Monitor and assess your conversations and meetings. Is the execution, implementation, who, what, when, next milestones discussion front and center and dominant and committed to paper and reiterated more or less immediately in follow-up written communications? 1.7.4. Execution. Parting thoughts 4. One for the ages. This vignette from an NPR broadcast was quoted on my blog, tompeters.com. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I do not know what is in the envelope. However, if you show me, and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman that I will pay you what you ask." The man agreed to the terms and handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it and extracted a single sheet of paper. He gave it one look, a mere glance, then handed the piece of paper back to the gent and paid him the agreed-upon $25,000. On the paper. 1. Every morning write a list of the things that need to be done that day. 2. Do them. 1.7.5. Execution. Parting thoughts 5. Very little equals very big. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the war was lost. For want of a war, the kingdom fell. And all for the want of a nail. 14th century proverb. And shades of Conrad Hilton, who launched this chapter with tucked-in shower curtains, right? Section 2. Excellence. Chapter 2. Excellence is the next 5 minutes. My story. Call it the saga of the Good Friday computer crash, or ballet comes to business. It was Easter week 1978. The main computer in the San Francisco office of McKinsey & Company, where I worked as a consultant, chose to crash 36 hours before our managing director was scheduled to give a report on an important project to the top team at Dart Industries in Los Angeles. With the computer down, his team was unable to prepare the sort of presentation he wished to make. I, meanwhile, was working frantically and independently on a project commissioned by the powers that be in the firm's New York headquarters. Though I was psyched by the project, it had the uninspiring title of Improving Organizational Effectiveness. John Larson, the San Francisco McKinsey boss, came to me in desperation, Dart was a core client, and said in effect, "Can you put something short but somewhat sweet together and fob it off on Dart and save my ass?" "Sure," I said in a flash, "one dreams of saving one's boss's ass, right?" The time frame was more or less instant, and I was desperate to get on with it immediately. However, my wife and I had tickets for the San Francisco Ballet the night the assignment landed in my lap. So wishing to avoid yet another fight over once again missing something that matters to me, I reluctantly traipsed off to the opera house where the ballet company performed. Though a ballet novice and stressed to the breaking point, I was mesmerized by the beauty and grace of the performance. I got home about 10:30 p.m. and, in a daze, dutifully went to my home office and started pulling material together for Dart. I honestly have no idea what next transpired, but I do know, bic pen in hand, the emotion stirred by the glory of the ballet in my psyche, I crafted a draft cover page with but one word, in all capital letters, excellence. You see, I got off on this stuff about organizations that don't work very well and what we might do about it. It was the topic of my then recently completed, 1977, Stanford Business School PhD thesis. And I think that what went through my mind was something like this. Hey, we spend the lion's share of our days, our lives actually, in organizations. What if that organizational experience was an upper instead of a downer? Polls show that about 30% of people enjoy their job. Mind-blowing ballet in front of my mind, my reasoning went, ballet is an organized human endeavor that produces beauty and grace and, at its best, excellence and blows the minds of its customers. Why the heck can't life at work mimic ballet? Why must, quote, amazing performance, unquote, be the exclusive provenance of ballet companies and football teams and the likes of an MIT science lab, but not the 24-person purchasing department? That is, why can't excellence and business be uttered in the same sentence? Absurd question, in retrospect. Of course they can. So on Good Friday 1978, I gave my presentation. It was well received and my boss was happy. I'm not going to imply that one heard the sounds of angels playing harps and darts LA boardroom, but I will tell you that somehow a switch had been tripped in my head. Yes, excellent business organization need not be an oxymoron. The business can be excellent notion percolated for years and influenced my extensive McKinsey research. Eventually, it made the cover of Bob Waterman's in my 1982 book, In Search of Excellence, Lessons from America's Best-Run Companies. To make a long story very short, a lot of people bought the book. There were numerous reasons for that, including good timing. American business was hurting, and business people were tired of hearing from best-selling books like The Art of Japanese Management that the only answer was to copy the Japanese. For God's sake, at the time, 1982, virtually all of the CEO's dads had fought in World War II. However, I'm convinced that one other very big reason for our success was our decision to pair those two words, business and excellence. Business and work can be exciting. Business and work can be an upper. Business and work can be excellent. My passion for excellence, the title of my second book in 1985 with Nancy Austin, has remained unabated for 40 years. You'll see several manifestations thereof in this chapter. There's no linear plot line that ends with an aha moment. Instead, I offer 14 snapshots of excellence, some of the best ways I've found of describing enterprise, and for that matter, individual behavior, at its tip-top excellent best. FYI, in 1999, a book was published by Amicon titled The 75 Greatest Management Decisions Ever Made, featuring Julius Caesar, Ted Turner, Henry Ford, Warren Buffett, and others of their ilk. Number 48 on the list, to my astonishment, was the spur-of-the-moment decision by John Larson to ask me to give a presentation to Dart Industries on Good Friday 1978. Welcome excellence to the world of business. The excellence narrative. 2.1.1. Excellence in management is a grand human achievement. Management is conventionally perceived as a dreary, mechanical, constrained word. But please consider a more encompassing, more accurate, more fulfilling definition. Management is the arrangement and animation of human affairs in pursuit of desired and societally worthy outcomes. Management is not about theory X versus theory Y, top-down versus bottom-up. Management is about the essence of human behavior, how we fundamentally arrange our collective efforts in order to survive, adapt, and one hopes thrive and achieve excellence individually and organizationally. Why start the excellence chapter with this riff? Odd as it may sound, I'm attempting to stress the abiding importance of and moral and artistic nature of management. That is, to make it clear that in fact good management and excellence in management are the pinnacles of human achievement. That is, accomplishing remarkable and worthy things through development of one's fellow humans. Sound grand? Sure. But I'd really like you, the boss, to think about your next day at the office as an opportunity to pursue no less than excellence in the arrangement of human affairs, thus making your employees and the world a bit better off. It also turns out that this is the best way to grow, create relatively stable jobs, and turn a profit. 2.1.2. Excellence or not? What is management to you? Your call. Managing as a pain in the ass. Somebody's got to do it. Punching bag for higher-ups on one end. Grouchy employees on the other. Blame magnet if things go wrong. Big bosses abscond with the credit if things go right. Managing as the pinnacle of human achievement. The greatest life opportunity one can have. Mid to long-term success is no more and no less than a function of one's dedication to and effectiveness at helping team members grow and flourish as individuals and as contributing members to an energetic, self-renewing organization dedicated to the relentless pursuit of excellence. Picking up from the prior section, I am aware that pinnacle of human achievement sounds quite grand. In fact, it is quite grand, and I mean it. My goal is to suggest that a management job, every management job, is anything but humdrum. It is a peerless opportunity to dramatically change the life trajectory of every employee in your charge, and also to provide services of the greatest value imaginable to your customers and to your community. I got into a bit of a spat over this. To be honest, it was my intention. I said in a presentation with numerous healthcare personnel in attendance that a manager could de facto save more lives than a surgeon. I'm not diminishing the life-saving acts of a surgeon, but over the course of a managerial career, one can alter, sometimes dramatically, the life direction of thousands upon thousands of people. You can, in short, provide growth opportunities that turn night into day for an extraordinary number of individuals. I intend through this assertion to toss the ball squarely into your arms. The opportunity is there, pinnacle of human achievement for the taking. Corroboration. In an Oscar acceptance speech, the late director Robert Altman said, "The role of the director is to create a space where the actors and actresses can become more than they have ever been before, more than they have dreamed of being." Such a view squares with mine almost word for word. Please reread. Pause. Reflect. I'd be willing to assign the word profound to Mr. Altman's "more than they have dreamed of being." 2.2. Excellence. Management is a liberal art. The discussion immediately above suggests that pursuing excellence in management is ultimately a humanistic endeavor. Such a description is, alas, hardly what pops to mind when one thinks of management education, the MBA in particular. 2.2.1. Liberally successful. A two-decade report card. Henry Mintzberg knows few, if any, peers in his decades-long effort to understand the sources of organization effectiveness. Among other things, in his masterpiece, Managers, Not MBAs, A Hard Look at the Soft Practice of Managing and Management Development, Mintzberg cites research that counters much of conventional wisdom. That is, over a two-decade period, the value of the MBA is eclipsed by the value of a liberal arts education. At graduation, business and professional degree holders in general, MBAs, engineers, lawyers, etc., have higher interview and hire rates and higher starting salaries than new liberal arts grads. Year 20. By year 20, liberal arts grads have risen farther than their biz and professional degree holder peers. At one giant tech firm, 43% of liberal arts grads had made it to upper middle management, compared to 32% of engineering grads. At one giant financial services firm, 60% of the worst managers, according to company evaluations, had MBAs, while 60% of the best had only BAs. I recall my PhD advisor at Stanford once saying, "Tom, When our students are getting MBAs, all they want is more finance, more marketing. When they come back for executive courses 15 years later, their goal is to get help on the people part and organization effectiveness. It is presumably in such arenas that the liberal arts majors excel, thanks to their more Catholic background from the start, hence the results reported above. Mintzberg, in fact, suggests that a philosophy degree is the best preparation for business leadership, tongue nowhere near cheek. I, for one, think he's got a damn good point. 2.2.2. Peter Drucker's assessment of his most important contribution, Management as a Liberal Art. At a seminar in 1999, the moderator asked Peter Drucker, generally considered the father of modern management thinking, what he thought was his most important contribution to the field of management. Drucker replied, "I focused this discipline on people and power, on value, structure, and constitution, and above all, on responsibilities. That is, I focused the discipline of management on management as a truly liberal art." I think that is no less than a staggering pronouncement. Typical MBA programs focus on quantitative analytics, which is what their clients, students, ask for. The soft stuff, people practices, organizational arrangements, are typically seen by those students as an annoying distraction from the main event. In recent years, consistent with Drucker's view, I've focused on shifting the MBA from Master of Business Administration to Master of Business Arts. I can hardly claim any great success, but in several instances, I have at least ignited some soul-searching on the part of business school deans and faculties. 2.3. Excellence, Enterprise Responsibility, Increase the Sum Total of Human Well-Being. In good business, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, best known for his book Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, argues persuasively that business has become the center of society. As such, an obligation to community is front and center. Business as societal bedrock, he says, has the, quote, responsibility to increase the sum total of human well-being, unquote. Business is not part of the community. In terms of how adults collectively spend their waking hours, business is the community, and businesses and those in them should act accordingly. The really good news, and I repeat myself and will unabashedly continue to repeat myself, community-mindedness writ large is a great way, arguably the best way, to have a spirited, committed, customer-centric workforce and ultimately increase, perhaps maximize, innovation, growth, and profitability. The excellence dividend is directly predicated on Csikszentmihalyi's idea. In the face of likely dislocation streaming toward us, business's moral role relative to its employees and community moves front and center. It should not and cannot be evaded. 2.4. Excellence. Work reconsidered. Why not joy? It may sound radical, unconventional, and bordering on being a crazy business idea. However, as ridiculous as it sounds, joy is the core belief of our workplace. Joy is the reason my company, Menlo Innovations, a customer software design and development firm in Ann Arbor, Michigan, exists. It defines what we do and how we do it. It is the single shared belief of our entire team. Richard Sheridan, Joy, Inc., How We Built a Workplace People Love. Could there be a tougher or more competitive business than systems software? No. Yet Menlo Innovations founder Richard Sheridan's weapon of choice for successfully competing in this bare knuckles arena is joy. Talk about stretching the imagination and laying down an exhilarating challenge. FYI, Menlo's performance is sterling. Empower workers? Fine. Engage workers? Fine. Create team spirit? Fine. Fine, fine, fine. Topics near and dear to my heart for many a decade. But Mr. Sheridan upped the ante by many a notch. Quote, joy is the reason my company exists, unquote. It's easy to read this, give a nod, and move on. I hope you don't do that. I hope you pause and think, what if? Maybe it's not over the top. I'll think about it. I'll talk to the team about it. Hey, it would be cool. Well, the guy, Richard Sheridan, is pulling it off in the most unlikely context. Would you please do that, think about it, as a personal favor to me and to Mr. Sheridan? 2.5.1. Excellence. Anywhere. Everywhere. Enterprise at its best. An emotional, vital, innovative, joyful, creative entrepreneurial endeavor that elicits maximum concerted human potential in the wholehearted pursuit of excellence in service to others. That is, employees, customers, suppliers, communities, owners, temporary partners. I'm at the end of the world, Siberia. My typically exuberant American flavor message may miss the mark by a country mile or 10 or 10,000, but I decide not to pull any punches. And absurd as it sounds, the challenging optimistic statement above more or less magically emerged from my jet-lagged mind. Is the statement above a common state of affairs in Siberia, or for that matter anywhere else? Of course it's not. But in the spirit of Richard Sheridan, joy is aspiration, I must ask, why not? Before dismissing this as pie in the sky and moving on, consider each of these words. Emotional, vital, innovative, joyful, creative, entrepreneurial, excellent. And then consider their opposites. Do you want an unemotional, joyless, uncreative, unexcellent workplace? Of course not. So I say, again, why not? Why not shoot for the moon? Sadly, in my experience, the average manager or enterprise boss doesn't even consider creating an emotional, vital, innovative, joyful, creative, entrepreneurial, excellent environment. She or he is often as not too busy focusing on cost-cutting or short-term, quote, metrics, unquote, to let her or his imagination run wild. So, please, today, this morning, take a deep breath, let your imagination soar. 2.5.2. Excellence. Anywhere, everywhere, a food truck in Brattleboro, Vermont. Excellence may well be Silicon Valley's top coders, Madison Avenue's renowned fashion retailers, a soul-rending balletic performance, and yes, you may even find it in Siberia. But I unapologetically believe excellence can be just as manifest in a food truck in Brattleboro, Vermont. To wit, and I quote from the summer 2017 edition of Southern Vermont Arts and Living, Southern Vermont's top 10 food trucks. There's something about ordering your menu selection from a sandwich board, watching the chef prepare your meal, and enjoying it picnic style in nature. Here are the top 10. Andre's Polish Kitchen, Brattleboro, Vermont. Former New York City Russian Tea Room chef Andre Mikoyanyet cooks the traditional food of his homeland at his stand. Bert's Chuckwagon, Dosa Kitchen, Rose Petite Fete, Tito's Taqueria. Tito Garza learned to cook authentic Mexican food from his grandmother. Jamaican Jules, Westminster, Vermont. Caribbean chef Julian Jules Perkins. Mio Bistro, Dorset, Vermont. A favorite is the crab and corn chowder. We sell out of it. Smokin' Bowls, Bellows Falls, Vermont. Meats which come from the Ephraim Farm in Springfield are smoked in a kitchen a few miles away and go into the popular pulled pork sandwich. Taste of Thai, Brattleboro. Two Neanderthals smoking BBQ. Excellence, food truck, Brattleboro, Vermont, Westminster, Vermont, Dorset, Vermont. Why not? 2.6.1. Excellence of service. Organizations exist to serve, period. Leaders live to serve, period. Service is a beautiful word. Service is character, community, commitment, and profit. Service is not wow. Service is not raving fans. Service is not a great experience. Service is just that. Service. 2.6.2. Service is the highest human calling. This all-powerful idea is directly derived from Robert Greenleaf's extraordinary book, Servant Leadership. Here are two exam questions that Greenleaf urges leaders to ask concerning the people on their team. 1. Do those served grow as persons? 2. Do they, while being served, become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, more likely themselves to become servants? Well, one tough test, eh? And if you buy my act and the logic of this book in general, a self-test that must be performed daily. Of course, I still love the word and notion of, for example, wow. But the idea here is to ask you to pause and reflect on this beautiful word in its purest sense. Service. I ask you to reflect a lot in this chapter, and that's purposeful. Excellence is not a metric. It is a state of mind, a way of being, the marvel and magic of the San Francisco Ballet. The animating idea powering this book is excellence is the best antidote to the tech tsunami. It is, as I see it, the best antidote because it is ultimately human, spiritual, know it when I see it. So, yes, the clarion call of this chapter is, in a word, reflect. 2.7.1. Excellence equals the next 5 minutes. Excellence is not a long-term aspiration. Excellence is the ultimate short-term strategy. Excellence is the next 5 minutes, or not. Excellence is your next conversation, or not. Excellence is your next meeting, or not. Excellence is shutting up and listening, really listening, or not. Excellence is your next customer contact, or not. Excellence is saying thank you for something small or not. Excellence is the next time you shoulder responsibility and apologize or not. Excellence is pulling out all the stops at warp speed to respond to a screw-up or not. Excellence is the flowers you brought to work today or not. Excellence is lending a hand to an outsider who's fallen behind schedule or not. Excellence is bothering to learn the way the folks in finance or IS or HR think or not. Excellence is way over preparing for a 3-minute presentation or not. Excellence is turning insignificant tasks into models of excellence or not. Excellence is conventionally, in fact, almost without fail, seen as a long-term aspiration. I disagree, vehemently disagree. Excellence is not a destination at which you arrive on a glorious sunny day after years of brutally hard work. Excellence is a way of life that sustains us and inspires us day in and day out, minute in and minute out. There is no long term. There is only the way we act when we step out into the corridor after a meeting. Or, yes, the quality of your next 4-line email. Yes, damn it, the quality of the next email. Leaders are always on stage, always equals, always equals, always. And even the tiniest manifestation of leader behavior reinforces or diminishes the commitment of the enterprise as a whole to excellence. You can call me a nutcase if you want, but I insist that lousy grammar, poor word choice, carelessness of any sort is a direct reflection of the level of your commitment to excellence. The manifestation of excellence or not, in our moment-to-moment behavior is the bedrock beneath the bedrock. 2.7.2. Excellence equals 1 minute excellence. A tale is told about the fabled IBM founding chairman Thomas Watson. Mr. Watson, how long does it take to achieve excellence? Watson, 1 minute. You make up your mind to never again consciously do something that is less than excellent. Hence, if you're inclined, your journey toward excellence can begin in the next 60 seconds. 2.7.3, excellence equals less than a minute. Rance Crane of Advertising Age interviewed Linda Kaplan Thaler, founder of the ad agency Kaplan Thaler, upon her induction into the Advertising Hall of Fame. Linda said the reason her agency grew so fast was because we never concentrated 1 minute on the future. We always focused on what we can do today. I always tell people, don't spend 1 second thinking about a vision. Forget about it. Don't dream your way to success. We never thought about becoming too big or hugely successful. We just did the best we could every day. Forget the future. Not worth even a minute. Forget vision. Not worth even a second. Forget dreams. Do the best you can right now. Please consider that. 2.8. Excellence. Biggest life decision. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Viktor Frankl, one of the world's greatest psychologists and a survivor of a Nazi concentration camp. Message: you can take any damned attitude you choose to work today. In fact, choosing your attitude this morning is your biggest life decision. This is in no way an exaggeration, and this is another golden opportunity to express my commitment to excellence as short-termism. Something so seemingly simple as walking into the office with a smile can launch the entire day in a positive direction. One more time, this is not an exaggeration. Of course, there's nothing actually simple about it. If you have 1,000 items on your plate, the norm for most bosses, then bucking yourself up to smile and exchange a few pleasantries is not easy or automatic. But I beg you to think explicitly about it and act accordingly. Working on that opening smile may be the most important investment you make today. 2.9.1. Excellence. Profit is derivative. Our mission. To develop and manage talent, to apply that talent throughout the world, for the benefit of clients, to do so in partnership, to do so with profit. The mission statement of WPP, the giant UK-based marketing services firm. Generally, I cringe when confronted with a mission statement. Boilerplate invented by the few, top management, at a boozy off-site foisted on the many, 10 or 10,000 employees, and invariably honored in the breach. However, the WPP mission statement passes my muster. Here's why. Profit damn well matters, but profit is derivative. And, first and foremost, the sine qua non, profit is derived through a primary and wholesale and continuous commitment to develop talent. The WPP recitation inspired me to take a crack at this. Herewith, my proposed mission statement. Once more, 50 years in the making. People first. Try it now. Listen aggressively. Wow or bust. Excellence always. 2.9.2. Excellence. More than shareholder value. Maximize shareholder value as unforsakable commandment. Says who? Jack Welch, that's who. Time and time and time again. The aim was the centerpiece of his fabled 20-year reign at GE. But hold on. Here's Welch after retiring from GE in the Financial Times. On the face of it, shareholder value is the dumbest idea in the world. Shareholder value is a result, not a strategy. Your main constituencies are your employees, your customers, and your products. Yes, the Jack Welch, for so many years, vehement, uncompromising spokesman number one for the absolute primacy of shareholder value maximization. While increasing shareholder value is indeed an honorable end and is indeed demanded by some shareholders, Shareholder value maximization at all costs is at the very least questionable as a be-all and end-all, and, as it turns out, certainly not a legal requisite. Lynn Stout is a professor of corporate and business law at the Cornell Law School. She cuts to the chase in her short but very sweet book, The Shareholder Value Myth, How Putting Shareholders First Harms Investors, Corporations, and the Public. The notion that corporate law requires directors, executives, and employees to maximize shareholder wealth simply isn't true. There is no solid legal support for the claim that directors and executives in U.S. public corporations have an enforceable legal duty to maximize shareholder wealth. The idea is fable. Oddly, soon after reading Professor Stout's book, I gave a presentation to the leadership team of a major, that is over $10 billion in revenue, publicly traded electronic components company. With the book very much at the top of mind, I was at one point in conversation with the CEO and mentioned Professor Stout's assertion. His response went like this. I told my board that if they want to get the share price up 50% in the next 12 to 18 months, I could do it without raising a sweat, but it would destroy the long-term prospects of the company. I made it clear I wouldn't tread that path, and they'd need to find someone else to do the job. Harvard Business School Dean Nitin Arya and Rakesh Khurana get to the same point in an article in the Harvard Business Review titled, It's Time to Make Management a True Profession. It includes this passage. Managers have lost legitimacy over the past decade in the face of widespread institutional breakdown of trust and self-policing in business. To regain society's trust, we believe that business leaders must embrace a way of looking at their role that goes beyond their responsibility to the shareholder to include a civic and personal commitment to their duty as institutional custodians. In other words, it is time that management finally became a profession. The idea of management as an encompassing profession is intriguing. More intriguing to me is the implication that management in its current incarnation is not a broad-based profession. I would assume Naria's response to that would be something like, today's top managers are simply shareholder value maximization mechanics. There's more to life. Suddenly, in mid-2017, this topic caught fire. Duff McDonald came down on the Harvard Business School like a ton of bricks in his 657-page opus, The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. He argued that the HBS was started for the right reasons, to improve the quality of management in general. But in the 1970s, it went off the rails when the idea that business chiefs should ignore all but shareholder value took hold at the HBS and effectively suppressed other aims. The world in general, McDonald argues, suffered as a result. At the same time McDonald's book appeared, the business school's in-house journal, the Harvard Business Review, jumped into the fray with a scathing article by perhaps its most prominent professor, Joseph Bauer, titled, The Error at the Heart of Corporate Leadership. That error is, per Professor Bauer, the presumed duty to maximize shareholder value. What's the upshot of all this? Well, only time will tell. But, alas, I'm afraid I'd bet on the shareholder value maximizers holding their own. And along the way, the lion's share of our giant firms, with their innovation funds minimized by the short-term cost cutters and tech-firsters, will become less and less able to deal with the revolutionary forces heading our way, which in turn is why I'd put my money on the SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. See Chapter 4. 2.9.3. Excellence. Enough. The spirit of more than shareholder value is captured by Vanguard Fund's founder Jack Bogle in the introduction to his refreshing book, Enough. At a party given by a billionaire on Shelter Island, Kurt Vonnegut informs his pal, Joseph Heller, that their host, a hedge fund manager, had made more money in a single day than Heller had earned from his wildly popular novel Catch-22 over its whole history. Heller responds, "Yes, but I have something he will never have. Enough." To get a flavor for Bogle's book, one need no more than peruse the chapter titles. Too much cost, not enough value. Too much speculation, not enough investment. Too much complexity, not enough simplicity. Too much counting, not enough trust. Too much business conduct, not enough professional conduct. Too much salesmanship, not enough stewardship. Too much focus on things, not enough focus on commitment. Too many 21st century values, not enough 18th century values. Too much success, not enough character. Jack Bogle's passion shines through on every page of the book. The founder of the world's largest investment firm, $4 trillion under management in January 2017, and the father of index funds, says that there surely is, or damn well ought to be, more to life than shareholder value. 2.10. Excellence. Give-a-shitism tops any fancy technique. I didn't have a mission statement at Burger King. I had a dream. Very simple. It was something like, Burger King is 250,000 people, every one of whom gives a shit. Everyone. Accounting, systems, not just the drive-thru. Everyone is in the brand. That's what we're talking about, nothing less. Barry Givens, the former CEO of Burger King and architect of an extraordinary turnaround. I know Barry well, and this is a true bedrock belief. Mr. Gibbons's formulation inspired me to generate a related tweet stream. Here are a couple of my entries. 1. Suddenly realized how sick I am of this technique, Six Sigma, Agile, etc., versus that technique. Get respect, listening, acknowledgement, civility stuff right. Screw technique. 2. If you really, really, really give a shit about people, then other so-called miracle systems of management are secondary. 3. If you do not have a culture of respect, caring, give-a-shit-ism, applying so-called good techniques often makes things worse. More bureaucracy, less democracy. My personal bottom line, respect beats technique, listening beats technique, give-a-shit beats technique. Give-a-shitism, my rather awkward adaptation of Gibbons's mantra, is arguably key number one for an environment featuring productive, innovative employees, and thence happy customers. 2.11.1. Excellence beats success. Excellence beats happiness. Strive for excellence, ignore success. Bill Young, race car driver. Auto racing and producing a museum-worthy piece of art are one and the same as I see it. I believe that most any activity at its very peak deserves to be called art. In fact, the fundamental premise of this book is that to avoid the grasp of artificial intelligence and the like, we must move past commodities and the short-term profits associated therewith, the all-too-common measure of success, and introduce art into our products and services, which in turn will only occur if every employee is a wholehearted part of the endeavor. The graduates are also told to pursue happiness and joy. But of course, when you read a biography of someone you admire, it's rarely the things that made them happy that compel your admiration. It's the things they did to court unhappiness, the things they did that were arduous and miserable, which sometimes cost them friends and aroused hatred. It's excellence, not happiness, that we admire most. David Brooks, It's Not About You, an op-ed in the New York Times. Mr. Brooks is spot on, even if the formulation causes discomfort. It certainly is worthy of contemplation. At the very least, one must acknowledge that the attainment of excellence at anything is a product of extreme exertion and constant frustration, not just in the long hours required to reach the level of stellar performance, but in the even greater and perpetual exertions required to stay at or even near the performance peak. 2.11.2. Excellence, to me, is spiritual. apropos of the two quotes immediately above. Excellence, by my definition, is first and foremost a way of life, a way of behaving with care and respect toward one's fellow human beings, day in and day out, moment in and moment out. Excellence is, in short, spiritual. And again, for after all this